That is correct.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Moments of Truth, the show about my favorite moments from my favorite things. I'm Bill Coffin, and today we'll be discussing one of the best crime movies ever made, Michael Mann's 1995 neo-noir cops and robbers masterpiece, Heat. Our story takes place in Los Angeles, California. Professional thief Neil McCauley leads a crew of highly proficient bandits as they take down score after score. But when an armored car heist doesn't go according to plan, it leaves behind a crime scene that attracts the attention of the nearly supernaturally fixated LAPD Lieutenant Vincent Hanna. What follows is an intense game of cat and mouse as McCauley methodically plans an ambitious bank heist that will be the capstone of a long criminal career, and as Hanna and his team do everything they can to close the net on McCauley and his crew. What begins as a contest of wills between two professionals at the top of their respective disciplines becomes something much more personal as Hanna and McCauley's inexorable showdown reveals the true cost of the lives they have chosen. Heat's ensemble cast, starring Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Val Kilmer, Diane Venora, Amy Brenneman, and Ashley Judd, among many others, features a who's who of 1990s motion picture talent. One of the movie's major selling points was that it was the first time Pacino and De Niro would appear together on screen, but for lovers of Mann's previous work, Heat promised nothing less than a masterclass in cinematic storytelling, which is what they got, and then some. Heat's cinematography, editing, music, and plotting all bear the hallmarks of Mann's well-established style dialed up to 11. The look, sound, and feel of Heat would go on to inform subsequent Mann pictures, such as Miami Vice, Collateral, and Public Enemies. Heat's many characters populate a layered and intertwining tale that plays out like a Greek tragedy as its players move along their faded threads of obsession, emptiness, and isolation. Many of Mann's movies feature renegade antiheroes who can't reconcile their pursuit of excellence with their sense of fulfillment, but none of them do it better than this one. Here, being the best at something isn't a cause for celebration. It's the prelude to an aftermath. Heat was a meteor among the dinosaurs moment for 90s cinema in general, and for crime movies in particular. Its commercial and critical success influenced a ton of filmmakers, including Christopher Nolan, who cites it as a favorite and as a direct influence on his Batman movies. Heat's use of color has been widely imitated, as well as its sense of grit, authenticity, and depiction of Los Angeles as an infinite urban sprawl overcrowded with the world's loneliest people. This is easily one of my favorite movies of all time, and one that's been on heavy rotation with me throughout the nearly 30 years since it first blew audiences out of the seats. So I can't wait to get into it now. Let's get started. With me today is purveyor of dead tech postmodernistic bullshit, Tom Hespos.
Shut up, Ralph. Sit down!
Author of the bestseller Stress Fractures and Titanium, Chris Crenshaw.
I think the word you're looking for is metallurgist.
And LA food critic and Kate Mantling regular, Chris Swan.
So you never wanted a regular type life.
Outstanding. Everyone, welcome. All right. So we're just going to start this one by addressing the elephant in the room with this movie, because anybody who's ever seen this movie, and by the way, if you haven't seen Heat, I strongly urge you to pause this podcast and just go watch Heat. It's about 3 hours, yeah. And it's
come back to us tomorrow.
Come back to us tomorrow, exactly. I assure you, it'll be worth it. And even if you don't like it, it's worth seeing it just to appreciate all the references since then that other movies have made to it. Frankly, it's a very influential movie, as well as one that, you know, if you like the other movies we talk about in the show, you're likely to enjoy Heat as well. But as we've all talked before this episode, this movie is kind of like an endless string of pearls of moments of truth, right? You can kind of pick any 10-minute segment of this movie and find a moment of truth in it. But there are a couple sequences that are really, really legendary. And the one I'm going to call out is the one that I think people kind of talk about first, because it's the easiest one, which is this massive action set piece right around the 2-hour mark in the movie where, you know, for 2 hours, Vincent Hanna and his crew and Neil McCauley and his crew have been circling each other all around this great big bank robbery that's being planned, this super audacious bank robbery. Finally, the bank robbery goes down and Hanna's guys get tipped off and they manage to intercept McCauley's guys coming out of the bank. And what happens is this fully automatic firefight in the streets of downtown Los Angeles. The whole sequence from the beginning of the bank robbery to the final shot of the shootout, you know, it's about 10 and a half, almost 11 minutes. I mean, I've watched an awful lot of action movies. I watch an awful lot of gunfight movies, a lot of crime movies, a lot of cop movies. This 11-minute segment of film is probably one of the most riveting sections of film I have ever seen or will ever see. Like every once in a while I see it referenced on YouTube and I'll just stop and I'll just watch the scene because it is so compelling. It's so high octane. I remember when I saw it in the theater, I was just completely annihilated by it. It just blew me away for a bunch of reasons, not the least of which is, as with everything that Michael Mann does, he has a real obsessive attention to detail. And so like the actors drilled obsessively with the weapons so that when they handle them like they're actual firearms experts. And you notice that in the movie. And the sound was recorded with mics on scene as they fired live blanks as they shot. And so and you can actually hear the reports of the gunfire echoing across the buildings in ways you never hear in action movies. So like it actually sounded like, say, like news footage when you hear like when there's like an urban war going on. This is what that sounded like. And it was so just it was so overwhelming to me that at the end of the whole scene, and there's like ebbs and flows, like the gunfight goes on for so long, there's ebbs and flows in it, and tension builds and releases during the course of the scene. And it's not filled with like crazy flashy stunts. It's just like four guys with heavy weapons trying to blast their way out of a block surrounded by cops who really want to keep them there. And it's that simple, right? Straight mayhem ensues. And it's so intense that the whole thing ends with, it raises the tension one last time with Al Pacino one-on-one versus one of the guys in Macaulay's crew, and it's building, and the guy and it's Michael Cimino. He grabs a little girl as like a human shield, and he's running away with her, and he's walking, and the music builds up, and Hannah kind of flanks him. He's ready for him. He's waiting and he's aiming, and they zoom in. He aims again, and Cimino's shooting behind him. He turns around, and this moment where they lock eyes, and then wow, Pacino pops him in the head and just drops him, right? And the scene's over. And if you watch that with headphones on in particular, or on a really good sound system, after he shoots, like there's so much sound and gunfire and music. After it stops, it's silent, and you just hear Hannah go, oh, right? And you have this little exhalation. And when I was in the theater and he did that, the whole audience then went, oh, like everybody like collectively exhaled as well.
Collectively exhaled, right?
And there's only a couple times I've gone to movies and had scenes like that so wrapped up people had like a physical reaction to what they're seeing on screen. One was Saving Private Ryan during the D-Day scene, when like I remember when we have like a first person view of a guy who goes over the side and he's underwater, and when he comes up over the he breaks the surface of the water, I heard people in the audience like ex no breathe in, and that sort of thing. Or like a couple other movies when that sort of thing, but it happened in Heat, and I remember like I needed that to happen because I needed to exhale. I didn't realize how much I wasn't breathing during that scene. I could talk a whole lot more about it, but I just had to start with this episode with that scene because I want to open up the floor to you guys. What do you think about the scene? What do you come back to it? What did you take from it? What was it like the first time you saw it? Over to you, fellas.
Look, I love it because it's, I mean, well, fantastically realistic, in the way that, bullets hit cars and wreak their havoc on police officers. The only scene that I can really compare it to in terms of tension is the car chase in Ronin.
Oh, good one.
You know, it's just got that sort of rhythm that, oh my, where you're alternately on the edge of your seat and sitting back and leaning forward and sitting back. It's such a well-paced scene that like it when you said it was 11 minutes long, I was like, holy crap, that can't be. That I mean, it was like
I
2
just watched
minutes
it today and looked at the time again. I looked at the time, was like, oh my God.
long.
I mean, the second like De Niro walks in, the music's in the background, you just watch the guy, they case in the place, they knock out the guards, they get everything's going to plan, and the cops get that tip off and they're coming, and you're like, oh, who's gonna get there when? I saw
And
that.
who are you
I didn't
rooting
see
for?
this. I only saw this movie. I've seen this movie twice all the way through. I've seen parts, and they were both this year. I got married the year it came out, and we moved to Missouri, and so there's a whole lot of starting school, getting married. There's a lot of stuff I didn't see like that year, and I just never had seen it. So I never saw this in a movie theater. I saw it on my laptop with my AirPods, And even then, watching this scene and having heard about it and knowing what was going to happen, it literally blew me away, the sound there. I can only imagine what it would be like to be in Dolby Stereo in a giant theater.
Right.
But it was something else.
And it builds up slowly, and the guys are about to get away. The last, Shahirless, the Val Kilmer character, is the last guy out. And he's walking to the car, and there's a half-second shot when he looks up and he sees two of the cops trying to hide behind a U-Haul truck. Mm-hmm. And he just whips his gun up, and the music whips his gun up, loud, percussive. It's startling. It's almost like he's shooting at you, and literally he's shooting towards you, camera way, even though you know it's going to happen still.
Yeah.
And I read the cops are all the characters who are playing the cops are all, they're shooting in semi-auto, one round per pull of the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're, the idea is like, they're trying not to, like Chris, like you were saying, spread mayhem. And his crew could care less. They're just, and they're not firing in full auto like Rambo. I mean, it's full auto, but they're doing it in burst because they know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's impressive, and it's sickening at the same time, if that makes any kind of sense. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't take your eyes off it.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
It's one of those rare shootout scenes where it's in a way, to your point, Chris, it's remarkably exciting. It's adrenaline pumping. At the same time, you don't want to see anybody get hit. Right.
Right.
You know, because at that point, you're 2 hours into the movie. You're so invested in these characters. You're like, somebody's getting hit. And in fact, right off the bat, like in the opening fusillade, like one of the cops is killed outright. And you're like,
Yeah, one of the detectives. Yeah.
One of the detectives, you know,
drops. Ted Levine's guy. Yeah.
Yeah. He buys it pretty quick.
Oh, quick sidebar. This movie had two like Hannibal Lecter movie bad guys. Ted Levine, of course, from Silence of the Lambs, and Ted Noonan, who played the Red Dragon in
Was he the guy in the wheelchair who had all the plans?
Yeah. And Ted Levine, by the way, he was originally gonna play Wayne Grove.
Right.
And he looks so much like him.
Right. He was originally going to play Wayne Grove, but coming off Silence of the Lambs, he was afraid to get typecast. So he's like, can I be Bosco instead? I'm like, okay, no. But what's funny is that Xander Berkeley, who plays Van Zandt, the money launderer.
Yeah.
He was so years before Michael Mann did a movie called L.A. Takedown, which is basically.
Wait, that's William Fichtner, isn't it?
You're right. Sorry. Xander Berkeley is Ralph. I'm sorry. William Fichtner. Okay. Yeah. So Xander Berkeley, who played Ralph, he played Wayne Grove, an earlier version of this called L.A. Takedown. Right.
Okay.
So this is weird, like, you know, cross pollination of talent and whatever. But you get to know these characters, and like very quickly, I mean, and like, it's funny because like the cops, like the way this thing is shot, the police who are under fire, like when you see the bad guy shooting at them, you don't really see, because of the range of that, you can't really, you're not really seeing all the time, like the guy shooting and the cop who's being shot at, you know, I mean, they're too far away. Right. And usually if they're shooting, and then you cut to the cops as they're under fire, that sort of thing. But as a result, like, it's all very personal. Like, you don't see like little silhouettes just getting hit and knocked over, like in a conventional action movie. You know, it's like when people are getting shot, you're seeing like the reactions of people's faces, and you see the cops and like, oh man, we are in over our heads. And it's just a very interesting way they establish the humanity of all the belligerents, which is what elevates a scene. But
very true.
I watched the scene, I feel like I've just done a workout. Like my familiarity with this movie, like, I didn't see it in the theater. Like, 1995 was like full swing .com boom. I wasn't getting home until 2 o'clock in the morning pretty much every night. I missed a lot, but that, you know, it was in heavy rotation on cable for a while, and that's where, you know, like, all right, well, I got, it's one of those movies I saw in pieces and then watched all the way through, but that scene always takes so much out of me. Like, I feel like I need a rest every time that scene comes to that conclusion. And it's like, it takes you up and down so many times throughout it. Like, And like, I'm exhausted. And then you get that, like, the look, and he's like, oh, he's going to pick up that girl and use her as a freaking human shit.
Right.
I'd forgotten all about Chirito.
Exhausting. I can't do it.
I know.
Shehirlis gets hit. Macaulay grabs him, is like, come on, and like gets him. They steal the station wagon. And
yeah.
Hannah's like, everybody get down. There are all these civilians who are running around. Like, they're freaking out. They're not.
Yeah.
They're at the equivalent of Publix, and suddenly it's been turned into a war zone.
That's an important point, Chris. This movie really does capture the behavior of civilians in real life.
Right.
You know,
and Hannah's get down. Get out of the way. And when they back out in the car and they drive off, and Hannah tries to take a shot and he can't.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, oh my God, it's over. And then Pacino starts running again. I'm like, where is he running? Oh God, the other guy.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And like, you're like, this is never going to end, but not in when's it going to, just, I'm exhausted. Just give me a second.
Yeah.
Switch to decaf give me a moment.
Like, wait, there's another velociraptor loose in the park. I can't take it. It's exactly like, come on, you're just killing me. But you know, the other thing I love about this shootout scene, and this is very much, kind of speaks to the larger structure of the Heat and what we'll get to with your moments, is that, like I said, it's a very character-driven action scene. It takes time, and this movie takes the time with all of its characters, right? It pauses with all of its characters, and it runs rather long, but it needs to give oxygen to all things. Wants to give oxygen to, it's one of the reasons why I like it so much. Right before this massive sequence, we get two little glimpses of, we have Edie, who's like packing up her stuff because she and Neil are going to take off. And she's like, oh, great, we're going to have the start of this life together. And then we've got Krisha Harris's wife, played by Ashley Judd. She's, you know, she's with her kid doing their thing. And she's like, okay, you know, today's the day of the job and the money's going to be okay. And it's like, we kind of pause for a second to focus on the other half of these couples that are doing this thing. And then immediately after the sequence, the first things we see are scenes with the wives or girlfriends of the character of the bad guys who died, right? We see, you know, Chirito's wife, who's like, oh no, you know, this happened. Then we see the driver and his girlfriend, and right. they give them so little time, but like, you feel for her. Like, she has clearly put so much effort into trying to show this guy a path forward, and he's had such a long, tough run of it. And she sees what it's come to, and she's like, oh, and her heart just breaks. And like, this movie, it gives us this massive high octane scene that in any other movie would have been the end of the movie. Right. But no, in this movie, it's a reason for us to talk about other characters, to see what the aftermath was. And we have another hour of movie after the scene ends. Right. Like, we are by no means done. So that's the other thing I love about this movie, is that it lands at a point where it actually sets up, like, it's our break into the third act, which is something you would never expect a scene of this magnitude to be. And I just absolutely adore the role it plays in the larger story for all that. And it's one of my favorite action scenes of all time. It might be my favorite action scene of all time.
That scene with the driver's girlfriend, you're right. That's a really important scene in that it treats even the minor characters as human.
Yeah.
And important in that sense. And you know, it doesn't linger on them. It doesn't have time to linger on them.
Yeah,
but he gives them all their moments.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to that, I'll quote Michael Mann himself in an interview with the Directors Guild of America about this scene. And he goes, and it was talking specifically about like how and why like Macaulay's guys were so much more equipped to prevail in this sequence than the cops were. And he goes, Macaulay's unit wants to get out while the police want something else and are sending in their assets. Judged strictly in terms of scene analysis and character motivation, the police are used to entering a situation with overwhelming power on their side. When they're assaulted by people who know what they're doing, they don't do well. Macaulay's guys are simply more motivated and have skills that easily overwhelm the police. Choreography has to tell a story. There's no such thing as a standalone shootout. Who your characters are as characters determines your outcome. And I just love that about this particular scene. I think it says so much about it. And I think that's also a great way to kind of set us up for the other moments going on here, because this is a very character-driven action scene and a very character-driven movie. and other moments we have are all about that character development. So I just want to move on and get into that. So with that, we're going to switch over. And Chris Swan, let's go to your moment of truth. Talk us through what your moment of truth of this movie is. Give people a quick idea what happens in it, why you picked it, and what you take away from it.
So I picked the diner scene that comes about at the halfway point in the movie. And before then, you've got Pacino's character, Vincent Hanna, the LA detective, who's been circling De Niro's character, Neil McCauley. And Hanna just basically decides, screw it. He's in an LA helicopter. They found McCauley. They keep trying to track these guys. And they found his crew, but they keep getting lost. They keep ditching the police tails. Well, they found McCauley. Pacino gets the helicopter to take him nearby, drop him off. He gets in the car, pulls McCauley over. And that little scene is tense enough as it is.
Yeah, it is.
Where Pacino gets out of the car. They're on the freeway and he has a gun. You know, he has a pistol he's holding down. And McCauley's got one. Hanna walks up to the car and says, you know, how you doing? How about I buy you a cup of coffee? I remember at first, I'm like, because you don't really know why he's pulling him over.
Yeah.
And McCauley says, yeah, all right. And he follows Pacino and they go to this diner. And this was a huge scene at the time, even though I didn't see the movie when it came out. I heard all about this part because, again, like you said earlier, Bill, Pacino and De Niro had never appeared on screen together. They're both in, you know, Godfather Part Two, but in different timelines, and they just never met, right? So that alone, you have these two titanic, you know, film actors sitting across each other from each other at a table while everyone else in the diner is just doing their normal whatever. It's not deserted by any means. It's busy, but we have this conversation with these two guys. And you get the 6-minute conversation between these two characters where there's some, for lack of a better word, there's some dick waving among them, but mostly it's these two guys who they realize they're, in McCauley's words, they're like opposite sides of the same coin. They're both very driven. They're existential warrior monk-like characters, if you want to put it that way. They're just on opposite sides of the law. And Hanna is passionate and McCauley is calculating, but they see each other and respect each other for a moment. And they have this conversation where it's not just, so what do you do kind of thing. It's, yeah. It's very pointed and it's tension filled, but not in the sense that they're not going to pull pistols out and shoot each other in the diner. The tension's all psychological. The violence is going to come later. It's going to come with that shootout that you talked about, that we all talked about, and then what happens later. And they throw challenges down at each other. You know, I mean, I opened this up with that line, you know, so you never wanted a regular type life. And De Niro's like, what's that? Barbecues and ball games? Because I take down scores. You know, I do what I do. You do what you got to do. And Pacino's like, okay, I get that. But basically, you can't do that in this town. And De Niro's like, watch me. This is what I do. And the way they just look at each other and then kind of riff off each other, like it's like recognizing like. And that's what's at the core of this whole movie is it's these
game
two characters.
Game,
it's not. Yeah, it's not the action. It's not the shooting. That's great. All the and it's necessary in this kind of film, but it's really character based. And this is the kind of stuff that I like to write about when I write books. I like writing about crime, not so much because I want to vicariously commit crimes through fictional characters, not really, but because I like writing. Crime is a great way to look at characters and to look at society. And these guys live in this modern world, which is. It's kind of empty. McCauley lives in the house with no furniture.
Literally no furniture.
And Shahir was like, are you ever going to get around to it? Like that's, he has an empty, the only thing he does is taking down scores. And Hanna, who's Al Pacino at his scene chewing best, is Like the only thing he knows how to do is chase guys like Macaulay. He doesn't know how to do anything else. And he doesn't want to know how to do anything else. And De Niro's like, me either. Neither of them do. And they kind of, and they both smile at each other a little bit at that point.
Yeah.
Isn't this the scene, Chris, where, I mean, where the line that's the heart of the movie really comes in, where, yeah, you're nodding. You know what I'm saying? Go ahead.
Yeah, you're talking about that. You talk about the attach. Yeah, that don't get attached to, like, Macaulay's philosophy thing. Yeah, it's like,
yeah,
don't let yourself get so attached to something that you can't walk out the door in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat coming around the corner.
The heat.
And that's Macaulay says this to Hannah. And Macaulay says that, like, I think he says that three times throughout the movie. It gets repeated. And that's really his philosophy. And Hannah says, you know, what are you, a monk? He goes, no, I got a woman. What do you tell her?
Yeah.
No, say I'm a salesman. He goes, so you see me coming around the corner. You're just going to walk out, not say goodbye? And he goes, that's the discipline.
The discipline.
And I love the next line that's tossed off. Yeah. It's sort of this toss off from Pacino is, that's pretty vacant, no?
Yeah.
Remember I stopped the movie, had to rewind. I was like, wait, what was that? It's like, it's pretty vacant, no? I was like, my God, that is empty. Like, it sounds like, God, he's a badass. But at the same time, no.
Yeah, you're calling crime a discipline. That's bullshit.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He approaches it that way. Chris, I get what you're saying. You're right. And it's not really clear why he does this, unless it's because of the thrill of getting away with it. It says, this is what he does. He says, it is what it is. That's what he says. But then you have the final part of the scene, the real moment of truth, aside from that line, Chris, is, you know, Pacino goes, look, you know, if I'm there and I got to put you down, I won't like it. And I'll tell you something, if it's between you and some poor bastard whose wife you're going to turn to a widow, brother, you are going down. De Niro nods and says, there's a flip side to that coin. What if you do got me boxed in? And I got to put you down. He's like, yeah, we've seen each other face to face, but I won't hesitate. Not for a second. I am never going back, he says earlier. And so they both are like, maybe that's how it's going to be. Or maybe we'll never see each other again. And I just watched it again, like 2 hours ago.
Yeah.
And when they said, maybe we'll never see each other again. And I watched, and they there's this lingering shot, and they both look at each other like, yeah, that's not what's going to happen.
That's not
happen. They know. they know this is going to end with like, one or, yeah.
Sorry to go on about, but it sets up these two characters and what the stakes are. Yeah. And they both confess to each other how empty, especially Pacino. He's like, no, my life's a disaster zone. You know, because I spend all my time chasing guys like you around the block.
That's my life.
That's my life. And he gives us a little smile. And De Niro's like, okay,
yeah,
I got it.
Yeah.
It's just, and watching these two guys, it's simply them doing it, sitting in chairs across from each other talking. And with the inflections of their voice and their facial expressions and gestures, you want to learn how to act, watch this scene.
My understanding is that, and we don't really talk about how movies get made in this podcast necessarily, but I think I'll make an exception for this scene just because one of the things I love so much about this scene is that they didn't really rehearse it. They knew what they're going to say, but they wanted their interaction to be really organic. And I was reading about how, like, these guys are such black belt actors that, like, the slightest inflection, the slightest movement, shift of body, they're going to react off each other. And the scene we see in the movie is essentially the 11th take of that scene, right? And every time was just a little bit different. And so, like, things like, you know, that's a little vacant. Like, you know, there's like a lot of organic chemistry going on there. It's like, you'll never see a purer example of that, like, in that scene. It's so great.
It is great. I've heard also this is the, and again, I know we don't go too much into the backstory of how the movies are made, but it's based on, you know, this is based on a real life from the 60s, a cop and a criminal. And they both met at a diner and had a conversation very much like this.
Yes.
And but just watching these two guys do it and carry it off. And I'd read that too, Bill, that they hadn't, there were no rehearsals for this. They didn't do a table. They just went in and did it.
So I'll tell you again, this is another moment when I saw it in the theater. I mean, the hype around, this is the first time De Niro and Pacino are going to be on the screen together. That was real, right? People were like excited. And I remember I was sitting next to my good friend, you know, Pacino's approaching, you know, De Niro in the car, and he taps me on the shoulder. He's on the shoulder and he goes, "Here it is. It's going to happen." And like the whole theater was like quivering in anticipation for this scene. Like there was so, and it was just like, it was a packed house and everybody was just spellbound during that whole conversation. Like it was, I mean, our attentions were as fixed in that moment as they were during the gunfight scene. But like, this is like the most intimate of combat, whereas that was the most explosive of combat. Like these guys are just scanning each other for weaknesses, trying to figure out some sort of, it's like they go into it looking to get an edge on each other, right? Like they realize like, I'm going to get something out of here that maybe I'm going to need going down the line. But it's almost like people who hook up and accidentally fall in love. It's like they said, but on the way, right?
That's perfect, actually.
Because
no.
like
they share each other's, they share their dreams with each other.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, right? You know, and these guys do not know how to emote with each other. Like there's a lot about masculinity in this movie, about guys who just can't feel, don't know how to talk about these things, don't know who to talk about them with. And like with these guys,
they're women.
Certainly not their women. No.
I read an article. I was reading an article today about how this Heat is a film about love. So I went and read. Okay, is that just like a, you know, clickbait? What is this? And made a pretty good, like, especially in this very masculine world where these guys aren't. Pacino can emote all day long, you know, as a, you know, and Hannah.
Of course he can, yeah.
And apparently in earlier drafts, Hannah was supposed to have a cocaine habit and they just kind of got rid of that. But
yeah,
I think Pacino decided to keep some of the mannerisms.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll bring up later, but Macaulay doesn't want, like he shuns attachment, yet he realizes it's like he's finally woken up and he's like, I'm 50 and I'm alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do I, and Pacino's like, he's at least got a wife. Just they're on the downslope of a marriage, as he puts it. And he's got the stepdaughter he's trying to figure out. You mentioned this is a Greek tragedy. I would have said Shakespearean, but it is in a sense they're on these tracks.
Yeah.
They don't know how to get off and they don't particularly want to get off.
No. Uh-huh.
And it's mostly a game of chicken. Who's going to win?
Yeah. And that's why Tom Sizemore had to be in this movie. I don't think you could have made this movie without Tom Sizemore. Not in the 90s.
No.
No, and that's another. That's,
the action is the juice.
that's the closest thing. You know, the closest thing these guys have to families are the men and their gangs and their crews. And there's that thing where, you know, Macaulay looks at Chirito and that scene, he goes, they're going to do the score. He goes, I need to know you in or out. And you got a family, you got.
Yeah, you should be like, out.
Yeah, you should cut loose of this, he says.
And he's like, man, this is, the action is the, that's,
yeah.
I'm in.
Yeah.
De Niro's like, okay.
In order to be a character in this film, you've got to be like dead committed. And you always have to be continuously reaffirming your choice to be in or out. Like, I think there's.
Yeah. And I think it's worth, to that point, Tom, I think it's worth noting that, like, this movie's got lots of good guys and bad guys, lots of moral gray area. But I think the two characters we're meant to disdain the most are Wayne Grow, the loose cannon, and Van Zandt, the sleazy money launderer, both of whom are not particularly committed to much of anything, right? And this is a universe that abhors sloppiness and abhors lack of focus and commitment. And those guys are not, you know, and I think that's what you've seen those guys. And so as a result, we're really meant to hate them in particular. During that shootout scene, when Val Kilmer gets hit, the audience was like, no, even though they know he's a bad guy, like, no, he got hit, right?
And he is just gone through several clips.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, he's shooting at the cops.
And he has it. I don't think he's just hit cops. It's hard. Again, it's hard to see.
You can't tell.
You can't tell.
He's killed cops.
He's putting a lot of lead down range. Yeah, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody said no when Wayne Grove buys it at the end. In fact, that people clap when he gets, you know, and like when Van Zandt gets shot, you know, some people like were like, oh yeah, good, like we're waiting for this one. But no, like
Wayne Grove's the most, I hate him, and you're supposed to hate him. Yeah. The crew hates, you know, Chirito is like hates him 15 seconds in.
Yeah, right, exactly.
When he hops, he goes, I'm Wayne Grove, so you're normally in this crew. He's like, shut up, newbie. Like, just,
yeah. You know what's funny?
Slick.
Wait, yeah. Okay, stop talking. Okay, Slick.
The only reason reason he's in there is to make the suits to help.
Yeah.
Yes, the other criminals do horrible things, but Wayne Grove's just a monster. It's sort of
right.
It's almost like it's like, why do we like Hannibal Lecter? He's horrible. Yeah. Well, for a lot of reasons, but also because Buffalo Bill is like in many ways many many times more horrible immediately. Yeah. So
exactly,
Wayne Grove is the guy that makes Robin Hood commit murder, you know, to protect his band. You know, like you want to root for Macaulay because he's a protagonist, but you know, Wayne Grove makes him commit murder in practically the first scene of the film.
Yeah. The one thing I'm just going to say real quick about this particular scene is that like in a Michael Mann movie, there are no accidental details, right? Everything is there for a reason. And the one thing I've noticed recently, and this is probably me just reading in the movie, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, this scene where they're talking, right? These are two characters. One's on the downslope of his life. The other's on upslope of his life. They're meeting at that perfect midpoint for both of them. And one is looking to the other for guidance on how to ascend. The other is looking for guidance on how to not descend any further, you know, and they're both looking for something from each other, but they know it's going to end in violence. There's a bottle of ketchup between the two of them on the table the entire time. And ketchup is like shorthand for blood, you know? And I keep thinking, like, we see between them that there's this bottle of ketchup there. And I keep thinking that's their little, even as they talk and they get more intimate and they get more connected to each other, that bottle is still always like there. And so like this little reminder that like there will be blood between these two of them.
Chekhov's ketchup bottle.
I think it's Chekhov's ketchup bottle. I really do. Yes. I think it's exactly
someone's
what it is.
Spilling the ketchup eventually.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I could be reading into it, but that's something I've noticed in recent viewings. So anyway, Tom, well, let's go to your moment of truth. So walk us through the moment that you chose. Give us a quick rundown of what happens at that point in the movie. And most importantly, why, you know, what you take away from it. How does this moment kind of enrich your love for the film?
Yeah, it took me about 10 seconds to pick a moment of truth and probably about 6 hours for me to really digest why I love it so much. my scene is, you know, not maybe 10 minutes or so after the shootout scene. Hannah's coming home basically from, you know, he walks in the door of his wife's, you know, bullshit house. And
it is a cold domicile.
Her ex-husband's bullshit house. Yeah.
That's right. His ex-husband's postmodern bullshit house.
You know,
that's right.
Justine, his third wife, you know, like serving a bowl of something that's saying like it's ready. And then you realize that she's not talking to Vincent, that it's some guy like sitting on her couch, and Vincent like basically walks right into this guy.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh shit. Like, you know, after so long of, you know, it's beat after beat of this guy's life is a mess. And, you know, he's going through so much at work, and he's got, you know, work is his life and there really is nothing else. And this is the scene where it all just sort of comes crashing down for him. For me, you know, like you see the other guy, and you know, it's not immediately apparent because you're not catching them in bed or anything. The guy's just kind of like sitting on the couch.
Yeah, but that's post-coital, clearly.
It takes you a bit to sort of like figure out what's going on.
Yeah,
but you know, then it's like he almost has to be reminded to be angry about this for some reason. Like he's not very angry. He actually sort of like approaches it very calmly. He wants to know where his stepdaughter is. He wants to know like what's going on. And then like once he finds out, you know, she's like, oh, you're not even going to get angry? And he's like, oh, I'm angry. And then launches into the anger. You know, the thing he chooses to find to get angry about is not that this guy is screwing his wife, but that the guy is kicked back on his couch and is now watching his TV. So he decides he's going to...
Well, Tom, that's his television set.
It's his television set. My television. You do not get to watch my television. And, you know, he picks up this disgusting little 13-inch, like,
right,
VCR combo, you know.
Like a tape deck, right, in it. It's crappy.
But now it's just pathetic, you know. Like,
yeah.
even then it wasn't great
under his arm and tries to get out the door, you know, where it's where he has the more poignant sort of conversation with his you know, about to be third ex-wife, and basically, you know, the talk about how he has basically blundered through his life, like without really giving a crap about, you know, the relationship or anything. His life is really just this catching crooks. His wife feels like she had to sleep with this loser named Ralph.
She's like, I may be stoned out of my mind and high, and I had to just sleep with a loser. Like,
I had to humiliate myself. Yeah.
And Ralph's like, what?
Like, what? No. Like, yo, what? Hey,
I'm right here.
Yeah,
exactly. Sit down, Ralph. And he's like, okay.
I see her point. Yeah. Like, but like, she's kind of right. But like, you know, in between you get that funny bit, you know, where like, you know, Ralph tries to just like discreetly exit, you know, like, you know, hey, I didn't know you were married. Hey, yeah. No, like,
I had no idea.
To do with me. I'm going to get out of here. He's like, shut up, Ralph, sit down. He does it. And you love that because you're like, if I had a bit part in a movie, I would want to be Ralph because
you get yelled at by Al Pacino.
I mean, yeah.
Privilege. And like, I can't act, but like, if I ever could just enough to get a bit part like that, I want Ralph's part in that movie just to get screamed at by Pacino. It's so great. Like, yeah. The guy's bigger and taller than him, and he just, all right, yeah, you know, I'll have a seat.
That would be my pinned post at the top of all my social media. It was just, I got yelled at on film by Al Pacino. Like that's there's nothing else I could possibly post that would be more awesome. That's great. So that moment is a weird moment because you're like, oh crap, what's gonna happen? Pacino walks in and he just you're right, he's calm. And I'm like, is he calm? Like, I'm going to be calm right before I break your neck. And he's like, no, he doesn't really care until he's reminded, like you said, he's reminded to be mad. And he's like, you're not taking my teepees. And you're like, what the hell is it with it?
It's only thing because
he doesn't know how to even.
Right. He's trying
about his relationship, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
I don't think that's quite true. I think he does. I think he doesn't know how to take care of it.
Right.
And, you know, in that moment, he wants to be the adult, but there's no real way to be the adult in that moment, you know? Like, so he gets mad about
whatever the television. Dignity he has, he's going to march out with his television set,
like,
which is
like
you're not making me look like a chump. You can cheat on me, but you're not going to make me look like a chump.
All I need
says
is this
the cuckolded husband who walks out of the house with a cheap ass television under his arm. Yeah. Right? That's that's what
like
makes
Steve
it
Martin,
so funny.
Man.
Yeah. No, it's like Steve Martin in The Jerk, right? All I need is my tennis racket. Just like walks out with it
and this lamp.
It's like, what are you doing? But what's so great
except
about this?
That it's Pacino, it's not Steve Martin, so it's a completely different vibe, which is what makes it so funny.
And a character who not 12 hours before like prevailed in this extraordinary gunfight in the middle of LA, like he's had a day, right? He didn't need to come home to this necessarily. So Justine's timing was a little suspect, but like this is a movie without a lot of humor in it, right? As is typical for Michael Mann's films, but much of the laughs that occur in this are from Pacino doing the thing for which he was known, especially at that time, which is like Pacino, you know, just Pacinoing out, right? Just like going bonkers. And like tapping into that whole notion of like, oh, is Hannah on cocaine or not? And sort of like has these explosive moments. And when he's like Ralph, shut out. And he just like plunks down. The theater just laughed hard. Like when we saw that, because you're like, yeah, like it's almost like the percussive force of his voice like pushed him back into the couch. You know, it was that sort of
force. He's Bene Gesserit.
Yeah, it's like your
NPC, go sit over there.
Like, yeah, exactly.
It's so alpha. Like, oh my God.
But you know what's cool about the scene is that it's then followed up by this little postscript where we cut to him. He's driving his car, and he gets to this intersection afterwards, and he's like waiting for the light to change. And he just opens up the door, and Tom, what happens?
Out goes the TV. Yeah, it's
right.
Like, we know you didn't all right. Crap about
that was stupid.
TV
exactly. Stupid TV. Smashes it and then drives off.
That was probably all a mistake.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, but like on its face, you look at it and you're like, this, it's like the little stupid TV. Like, you would pass this TV up today at a garage sale if it were being given away.
For Oh, yeah. For $5, like, it's not worth
$5
to carry it home. Man, the thing takes up space. And the other thing I loved about it is that, like, this is his TV. It's like sitting on the kitchen counter. It's not like a centerpiece of the room. It's just this, like, crappy accoutrement that really, it's like Hannah himself, is deeply out of place in that house.
This is what I brought into the marriage, so I am taking it out with me.
Like, right.
This television set.
Slow clap.
Yeah, like well done.
Square. Yeah.
Yeah. There are these doppelganger scenes throughout the course of the film. There's one where when Neil's team, I mean, Vincent's team is surveilling Neil's team having a group dinner. It's almost like,
yeah,
hey, that's a good idea. Maybe we should do that ourselves. You know, so then they have like a night out at the nightclub to kind of, you know, have a good time together. But of course, Hannah gets pulled away from it, right? His wife kind of like, you know, she has this really great monologue where she's like, this is the state of where we are, man. Like, what is this? And he's not going to meet her on that. So when she finally is like going out, like, you know, this is going to happen. He knew this is going to happen. And he took no preventative measures to stop it. And I think where you see this scene come to its tragic conclusion is towards the end, where Hannah is trying to prevent Macaulay from escaping the city. It's after the TV scene, so he's checked into his hotel where he's got nothing there, right? That's where he discovers his stepdaughter has tried to commit suicide in his bathroom, played by Natalie Portman, and I think her second film role. She's like introduced early in the movie as a kid who's got a lot of baggage she's carrying around. She really needs a dad. Hannah's like, that son of a bitch going to show? Is he going to stand her up like last time? And then promptly leaves the house. Like, he's not there for her either. Yeah. And we see her once more in the movie. She's just hanging out and he picks her up. And then she's intentionally an afterthought in the movie because she's an afterthought in his life too. And
yeah.
even after he sees her and brings her to the ER and is there with his wife, he gets the call about Macaulay. And it's like, even then he goes, right? Like, even then he leaves. The job can even supersede his need to be with his stepdaughter who almost killed herself. And
I thought what was different about that scene was that, because he gets the thing in his pager, for being in 1995, I was always surprised, like, oh, it's not modern. Like, it seems like it still seems almost like it's a modern world, except for how they talk about cell phones.
Yeah.
And they have pagers.
Yeah.
Other than that, it still seems like it could be today. But
yeah,
you know, he gets the page and she's like, they're in the ER and they found out she's alive. And he's like, nah, I'm good. And I think he kind of means it. And she tells him, no, go. And he's like, what? She's like, it's okay. And they've just had this talk where she's like, do you think we can ever, we can make this work? And he says, I'm not what you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, but they care at some level. I know the movie opens up with them in bed together and you're like, and you're like, that's a complete, that's the best it's going to be. Like, it's all from the rest of the movie with them. But they do kind of connect. I mean, I think they make more sense in some ways than the doppelganger with Macaulay and Edie. And I'm not going to talk about her yet. That's Chris's thing. But And I remember wondering, why is Natalie Portman in this movie? Like, why? Like, what's she doing? And then I was like, oh, shit, this is why.
Yeah.
Adding her resume. Yeah.
Well, I know, but I was like, why? Like, because every actor, and I know not every actor was big yet, but there were a lot, like, all these, everyone is in that movie.
Yeah.
I kind of was like, I felt sad for them.
Yeah, no. Same. But all through
their relationship, though, he has acted as if like he's owed some sort of credit for being brutally honest about how he's going to behave through the course of that relationship. He's this is, you know, what you see is what you get. And, you know, I'm going to be at work and this is the thing that I do and don't expect anything else. And like, it's very much like what did you think was going to happen?
He has that horribly, he says, what do you want me to share with you, Justine? You want me to tell you about how I went to a hotel room where there was a crack addict who threw a baby in a microwave because it was screaming too loud? Do you want me to come home and share that with you?
Yeah.
I remember thinking, good God, that's...
He weaponizes
them. He really feels like he's shielding her from all stuff.
But
his role. But he does, then he goes, fine, you're going to know, now I'm going to turn that shield around and use it as a weapon.
Yeah. He actually he weaponizes the notion of intimacy with his wife, you know, just because, you know, it's all very backwards and messed up. And it's it only has one outcome, to be honest. You know, I do love the scene where the television scene just to kick it all off, because it's like,
right.
like we actually needed a laugh at that point, and that was an important plot point. We needed something to kind of giggle over, because the movie is so heavy at that stage. So
it gives Justine some good scenes. You know,
yeah, she does.
Chris was making a point. Yeah. Like the minor characters, the women in this film get some good scene where you typically they're just like, you know, Danny, yeah. don't go. I got to babe. I got to do that. And then they leave.
Yeah, right.
Well, they're the victims. Yeah. And they all get some great moments in here.
Yeah, so sure. Right. So I think that's a perfect pivot point to go to our next moment of truth. Chris Crenshaw, we're going to switch over to you. Walk us through the moment and time it occupies in the movie and what you love so much about it.
I'm going to ask you for a moment of indulgence, because I think we dipped into this in the last segment, but I want to talk about the cast of this movie for just a moment.
Yeah, sure.
Independently of a moment of truth, ignoring the leads, John Voight as Nate, the guy who's providing for Macaulay. The entire film, I was absolutely convinced he was going to screw Macaulay over.
Yeah.
And there's no plot reason for that to happen, but I don't think it's accidental. That's just good filmmaking, man. Like I love the way they used him. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Ashley Judd looking more human than she ever has, honestly. Like terrific. she's such a beautiful woman, but she looks so human and vulnerable here. I loved her. Mm-hmm. You know, Wes Studi, awesome. Oh,
yeah. So good.
We've talked about Natalie Portman and William Fichtner a little bit. Hank Azaria, of course.
Poor Hank Azaria.
Poor Hank Azaria.
That Pacino, you know,
she's got a
great
right ass.
Your head's right on your head. and if you watch that, Hank Azaria's like, and later I read he's like he had no clue Pacino was going to do that.
Yeah,
it's not in the script. So his look of fear after that, Hannah's like, I don't know, when I think of an ass, a woman's ass, things just come out of me. And Wes Studi is behind him, laughing like this, like this Hannah just doing his thing.
Yeah,
even in a background like that, Studi was great. They were all
yeah
sorry, so just that moment, this those guys was awesome.
Yeah, so
in this movie, Danny Trejo plays a character named Trejo.
Yeah. Yeah, he does,
which is awesome.
Yeah, it right. is.
Henry Rollins is in this movie.
Yes.
Tone Loke is in this
Tone
movie.
Tone Loke, man.
Oh, yes.
What do you want for that? A Junior G-Man badge? Yeah.
Jeremy Piven.
Yeah. Yes.
I love this cast. It's a smorgasbord.
Yeah.
But my moment of truth is, you know, we've been talking about, you know, ever since the gunfight, we've been talking about the relationships these characters have. And they're really the heart of the movie. You know, you have these chases and these gunfights and these action scenes, and they're set pieces, and they're kind of like the architecture of the film, but the meat of it is the relationships. Mm-hmm. And when Chris is having difficulties with Charlene, she can't make him understand what she needs, he can't make her understand what he needs, you know, you feel that. But Macaulay enters this relationship with Edie, who is a complete cipher. She just speaks to him at dinner, and he reacts in paranoia, right? Like he's just like, why are you so interested in what I'm reading? And they somehow make a connection, which I don't know. I think has to speak to how broken both of them are. Mm-hmm. I don't actually see a relationship there. It's just two people needing someone and failing to find what they need.
They haven't found it anywhere else.
Because
they've got, that's what they've got.
My moment of truth is the moment when, after the gunfight, after the bank robbery's gone bad, they've still got some of the money. Macaulay has their path, you know, through Nate out of the country into Mexico with Edie. He's got her in the car, and on the radio, he hears what he shouldn't have heard, and he turns around and goes back to the hotel for Wingrove. He stops at the hotel, and he's telling her, no, I just got to take care of some business. But he's stopping there for vengeance and only vengeance. And it's an expression of his values that she cannot understand or accept, and that takes him out of her life forever. There's a scene, you know, after the whole long hotel scene where he comes back out to the street and the car and looks at her through the car window, but he sees Hannah down the road coming toward him. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he knows anything, any contact he has with Edie at this point only hurts her. Like he cannot be with her, and he's doing his best for her by not hurting her, by not talking to her, and just walking away. But you know, the decision was made the moment he got out of the car and went to that hotel. There's no answer to that for her, and I don't know. I still am not sure what she thought she was finding in him. He was a man who seemed intelligent and together, and I don't know what else. But
paid attention to her, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't pay attention to Amy Brenneman?
For goodness sake. You know, I think one of the things that I took away from this movie, and I've read this, is that man's portrayal of LA, right, is very different than what we see in a lot of other movies, right? And how, like, it's, you know, it just the reality that LA is really a collection of like 88 small cities all crammed together in LA County, right? It's just this, it just extends in infinite directions all over the place. It's not all, you know, Santa Monica or whatever. Like a lot of big cities, it's easy for you to feel very much alone there, right? And I think she's feeling very much alone. When they first meet each other and talk, he's like, I am alone. I am not lonely. Like, that's the most false thing he ever said, right?
Exactly.
And he's like, how about you? And she goes, I get real lonely. And I think that I think it might be as simple as she's really lonely. When you're lonely, I mean, that hurts a lot. And they have their night together. And I think the thing he does as he leaves is he leaves a glass of water on mm-hmm. the table for her and wraps it in a napkin, right? It's just this little extra effort of care, and that's probably more personal attention, like intimate attention she's received in a really long time. So like, well, like you said, she's a cipher that will fill up a lot. You know, that little moment of connection, right?
Yeah, but that to me is why it's so heartbreaking, you know, like, you know, that poor woman didn't deserve any of what she got. And you know, on the other hand, I can see why he was reaching out for something, and I can respect his decision to leave her out of it at the end, but you know, you want to shake him just like you want to shake almost every character in this movie.
Don't go in the hotel, don't leave the car, drive off with Amy Brennerman. Like, what are you
who still has the money, who still has the money in the trunk, by the way. She still has like a third of that $12 million take, right?
So. Or stay in bed with Justine. Like literally every character in this movie had a better choice to make, and they all make the wrong one.
It's all part of that, you know, like you got to be in 100%. You know, you get the choice has to be crystal clear for the person watching the movie.
There's the scene where the McCauley and his crew are all having dinner, and he's looking around. He's sort of, it's almost like he's the paterfamilias, kind of looking around, like looking at my boys.
And he's the one that's lonely.
Right. And he looks at all and he smiles because they're like, he sees Chris is hanging with Charlie. He's like, okay, that's been fixed. He sees Chirito's got, you know, given a gift to his wife, all that kind of stuff. And then
don't ask
then
how he paid for it. Him.
Right. It goes back to him, and he's like, yeah, and you could mean that to be like, and they're going to stick me with a check or something like, but he has this look like, oh. And the next thing he goes and he calls Edie. And Amy Brenneman apparently got the script and was like, I don't do movies. Like, thank you. But I don't like, this is this world. There's this world's too like violent and dark, and there's nothing in it for me. And Michael Mann said, that is exactly why I want you in it.
Yeah.
That's why, because you don't fit.
Yeah.
Chris, you know, when Macaulay comes out of the hotel and sees Edie and he sees Hannah, you know how long it takes him to leave? 30 seconds of film time, which is an eternity. Beautiful. He looks. I remember I was like, why doesn't he leave?
That's beautiful.
And I was like, holy shit. The second time I watched it, I was like, oh. And I went back and looked. It's like, yep.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Man clocked it, and then he runs.
Yeah. There's also 30 seconds when he's driving through the tunnel and he gets the news about Macaulay. What is he going to do? He spends 30 seconds deliberating on that as well.
That was a great, they come through the tunnel and there's this lens flare. But it's not the cheesy kind with J.J. Abrams. It's this bright white light, like they're almost going to hell, like kind of thing. And he comes out of it and he's like,
He's out. He's free at that point.
Yes. And he's like, jerked off the car. I got something I could take care of.
So, you know, Chris, I have to ask you a question though. So I get the whole notion of like Neil is trying to spare Edie from running away, but I'm not. So I see Tom shaking his head. I'm with you, Tom.
No,
I don't think he's trying to spare. I think he's
breaking his own code, you know, like and realized it. And
yeah, I think he took 30 seconds because that's all he had to take by his own survival instinct and enjoyed 30 more seconds with her before he ran off, because ultimately it was about self-preservation. And I think had he could have reached in the car, go come with me and run, but he knew he wasn't going to get away with her in tow. So I'm not certain there was a nobility there. I think it was there's for me, I thought it was ultimately survival instinct.
That's entirely credible. Well, it wasn't successful for one thing.
No, you know, but it was not. No,
because he should have kept going in the car.
That's a hell of a final chase, though.
Oh man, like that. No that, dialogue. That scene with zero dialogue for like 10 minutes, and the lights of the planes coming over. Oh, yeah.
I mean, Mike Amanda is a set piece like nobody else. I mean, honestly, it was just. And you know, what's so cool is that like during that final scene, it's like. The light is just coming from every which way. And like, as a viewer, I could not parse the geometry of that scene. Like, if they're all running around looking for corners, I could not try to get ahead of the characters going, okay, I think Macaulay would be around this corner or Hannah be around that corner.
No, right. I was so well done.
I was completely discombobulated. I was like, anybody could pop out from any angle and shoot each other. And it was like horror movie level tension. I'm like,
neither of them had any idea where the other was at any point.
Yeah. It was so rough. So rough.
Yeah. That whole thing where he gives her, Bill, to your point, gives her the glass with the paint. Like, it was really sweet. And there was something also, it's not pathetic. I don't know what word I'm looking for. But I was like, oh my God, you guys are, you are so broken.
Yeah. No, pathetic.
I don't know how to humans.
And
that is pathos, like that napkin is pathos.
And then he goes back to her, and then when she finds out who he is, he comes home and she's like,
that was you,
what did you do, was that you?
Yeah.
And he's like, Michael knew what the risks were, and he's trying to convince himself of he knew he was gonna die, it's okay. And then she runs and he chases her. And she eventually decides to go with him. He's like, if you want to leave, you can leave. And she's like,
yeah.
She's like, she's trying to get away from him. And she kind of just leans into him like, I can't fight gravity.
Well, she runs out of the place and he's like chasing her up that hill, right? And she shouts, why did you do this to me? Right?
Yeah.
And I just got the sense like she's so lonely, right? And she's so bereft of her, of love. That I think she's like, here's where I am. I'm so far from home. I'm so alone. I've never been more alone in my life. I need somebody so bad. And then, you know, he basically lays it all out. And I got the feeling my headcanon or whatever, but I got the feeling she's like, I can either be alone or I could be with a murderous bank robber who still thinks enough of me to wrap my glass of water in a napkin. I guess I'm with the bank robber, you know, and it's not optimal, but it's better than nothing, you know? And like, I'm not convinced that she's aware there's a satchel of like $4 or $5 million in the boot of the car. but Neil's pretty clear, like he's got enough money to be taken care of. She won't have to work, right? That does not strike me as a motivation for her at all. She enjoys working. She doesn't seem like a person who's like, you know, gold digging or anything like that. She just wants to be with somebody, and nobody's asked her to the dance like all the time she's been in LA. And you get the feeling like this is a city full of people like her, you know? And so she's like victim number one of Neil's escapade.
It's not my experience of LA, Bill.
That's a good point. I will say this though, by the way. The first thing she says to him is she calls out the title of his book. She goes, "Stress Fractures in Titanium." And like, that's Neil right there.
Right?
Like, that's Neil Macaulay's character in a nutshell. Yeah. Stress Fractures in Titanium. It's like, man doesn't normally like put a bow on things very, very much in the storytelling, but he did there.
A little on the nose,
but I love him for it. You know, it'd almost be like if he was reading a book, like, yeah, because he's clearly, he's got the book because of that metal depository job they're doing, right? So he's doing research on that. But it may as well have been like, you know, like the book's called like Tough Nuts to Crack or something, you know?
but it should be, because you don't find a book like Stress Fractures and Titanium at Barnes and Noble.
No, you don't. You're talking about Neil and eating that little gesture he gives. It reminded these guys are broken. I'm like, where is love? And that just made me think of another moment. Another one of the minor characters, minor in terms of screen time.
Yeah.
Ashley Judd's character.
Oh yeah,
Shirley.
That. Yeah, when Chris is driving, and they're like, Macaulay Williamson, another great actor who plays one of the detectives, is like, you know, you're going to help us, or your kid's going to go into foster, and you know what's going to happen there. That's honest, and you're also a bastard for doing this to her.
Yeah.
And she's so like, cool. Fine, I'll help. And he's like, this is your only out. All you got to do is show up at the window, and he'll come up, and it'll all be over. No one will get hurt.
Yeah.
And she walks up there, and Chris looks, he's like, you're there. And she just, with her hand real quick. And I remember I thought, what's she going to do? And she does that, and his face drops. And I thought, she just gave away everything.
Yeah.
For him.
Yeah.
And he knows it. And he drives off, and he's devastated. You know, I thought that there is sacrifice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And like, he's the guy that lives.
Yeah.
He's the guy that lives, and he has paid this price that it's just a 3-hour film. There can only be so much character development. But my impression of his character is that was everything. Like, he lost everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he told Macaulay earlier, the sun rises
her, man. Yeah, exactly. Because the money is like, he's still a gambling addict, right? That money's not going to last forever. That's going to go pretty quick. And in Heat, there are two kinds of characters, right? There are the characters who maintain their love and die, or they lose their love and live, right? Because like Trejo sticks by his family, and he dies bad for it.
That was the second nicest thing Macaulay did in the movie, probably, was putting him out of his misery.
Yeah, for real. So,
water glass.
Well, he probably wrapped his pistol in a napkin before he shot him. So just to tell him, I love you, man.
I'll hold your hand.
I'll hold your hand. Exactly. I'll pat your hair as I put a bullet in your head.
I mean, they just hold it. Yeah, there's the hand holding at the end, which is like, that could have been really cheesy, and that was not.
No, I've seen that described as kind of like the marriage between Macaulay and Hannah, and it's this profoundly intimate moment, and just the way it's shot, I've seen it described as visual poetry, and just the music, like all of it, like you are left feeling so overwhelmed by the end of it, and you just see Pacino staring out over this field. He's like, where do I go from here? Yeah. And it's just,
what
like,
has he won?
Nobody wins. It's, I've never seen a movie that was so zero sum that didn't make me feel like cynical or angry or anything like that. I mean, there's a very deep melancholy to this movie. It's like strange. It's all melancholy with a purpose. Like, it's just not somebody just dunking on life itself. It's just this world in which people, they fall adrift from themselves. And there's a warning there, I think, which will bring me to my final point, actually. So before we wrap up, a final thought. One of my favorite things that I do when preparing for any given episode of this podcast is spending a Sunday afternoon researching the topic at hand. I will reread or rewatch or re-listen to the episode subject if I can, and I'll spend a fair bit of the day just reading up on criticism and background so that when we convene to talk about whatever it is we're going to talk about, I won't sound like too much of an idiot. Something I discovered while doing that process for this episode was a podcast called One Heat Minute, by Australian film critic Blake Howard, that ran for 166 episodes from 2017 to 2019. The idea was, each episode of this podcast covers just a single minute of Heat in sequential order and discusses the elements of the movie in detail, as well as how it connects to Michael Mann's broader body of work. It is a passion project of such breathtaking dedication and obsession that one imagines that maybe both Vincent Hanna and Neil Macaulay would have subscribed to it. For the final episode, the guest was Michael Mann himself, who said that when he first heard about One Heat Minute, quote, "I thought it sounded insane." The show's host took that as a compliment. Now, as we've mentioned before in this episode, Heat is a terrific examination of what might be Mann's central theme as a filmmaker, which is the tension between the obsessive desire to achieve and how much fulfillment that delivers relative to the costs it all demands. And anyone can be truly great at something, Mann seems to tell us in this movie, but it's up to us to decide if the cost is worth it. And I think about that when I encounter movies like Heat or even passion projects like One Heat Minute, which feel like they dip way deeper into the well than I have ever done for my own work. I have authored science fiction and fantasy games and novels for most of my adult life. I tend to partition my writing into times when I know it's unlikely to bother or impact other people, like when I used to commute on the train or when the rest of my family is asleep. My creative endeavors are non-negotiable to the point that they are something I must do or else I feel that I will burst. But they are not so non-negotiable that they can't find a place in line with the other priorities of my life, family, my profession, my friends, my hobbies. The truth is, I obsess over my art, but only to a point. And it's probably a point below the threshold that's required to propel my efforts into greatness. Heck, you may not even be propelling it into goodness. That's a determination only others can make. And while there are nights when I lose sleep over the notion that I only have so much time to do the things I want to do, as Neil McCauley says, I find that as I get older, I am increasingly at peace with knowing that I won't get to do them all. And I'm increasingly at peace with knowing that I probably won't achieve greatness either. Admitting to oneself that not everyone can be Michael Mann and accepting that reality might very well doom me to mediocrity, but at least it won't doom me as a person. And I can live with that because the alternative doesn't sound much like living at all. And I think that's what Mann was trying to warn me about with Heat. But you know, I probably won't know for sure until I watch this at least another 1,000 times. This has been Moments of Truth. On behalf of myself, Tom, Chris, and Chris, thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time. Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Fluherty and A Little Help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life, but will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org.